We would like to acknowledge that the land which we are gathered on today is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. Ontario is covered by 46 treaties and other agreements and is home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and the Métis. These treaties and other agreements, including the One Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, are agreements to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. Other Indigenous nations, Europeans, and newcomers were invited into this covenant in the spirit of respect, peace, and friendship. Most of us have come here as settlers, immigrants, or newcomers in this generation or generations past. We are all treaty people. Every day, we are mindful of broken covenants and we strive to make this right. We commit to collaborating based on the foundational assumption that Indigenous peoples have their power, strength, and competency to develop culturally specific strategies for their communities. We are dedicated to honoring Indigenous self-determination, history, and culture, and are committed to moving forward in the spirit of reconciliation and respect with all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people. Good morning, everyone. My name is Linda. I am one of the education facilitators for the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. Welcome to our podcast today. Our podcast is entitled Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. And today, I would like to warmly welcome one of our nurse consultants, Catherine McEwen. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Linda. How are you this morning?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
What is the journal article that you are going to review with us today?
It is called Managing Death in the Field, Pre-Hospital End-of-Life Care. It is from the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, Volume 60, Number 4, and it was published on October 2020. The people involved in this study were Deborah P. Waldrop. She is a social worker, a master social worker, Michael R. Waldrop, an MD, Jacqueline M. McGinley, also an MSW, and Charlotte R. Crowley, an MD, and Brian Clemency, who is an osteopath with an MBA.
Can you explain the purpose of this article for us?
So the purpose or the objectives of this article was to explore pre-hospital providers and their perspectives on how legally binding documents, such as a DNR order, and medical orders for life-sustaining treatment informed end-of-life decision-making and their care in the community.
Well, this will be certainly relevant for our listeners in palliative care. Mm-hmm. What were the methods used in the study?
So the methods that were used in this, it was a two-stage convergent quantitative qualitative design. There were two phases. The first phase included the collection of survey data that was basically surrounding, they sent out a Survey Monkey and they used, with permission, they used a survey that was conducted in 2004 by Schmidt et al. About physician orders for life-sustaining treatment in the field, and they have seven domain questions that they use, that they follow. One of them was the demographics. The second one was the frequency of the medical orders, frequency of end-of-life situations, decision-making when there was assigned non-hospital DNR accessible, and decision-making when there was no signed non-hospital DNR. Their personal experiences with medical orders for life-sustaining treatment and the opinions that they had about medical orders for life-sustaining treatments. And these surveys were basically to be completed in 10 minutes to encourage participation. The second phase involved an in-person interview that was basically lasted, I guess, 30 to 45 minutes with each of these participants. And the way they got them to participate, it was the last question on the survey was to invite them to be involved in an interview. All of these participants were, they were anonymous and they were volunteer.
Can you explain the recruitment and procedures that were used to gather their data?
they reached out to four different EMS medical units. There were four agencies that they used. They were in the Northeastern state, and I believe that the state is New York. They don't really specifically say in here, but they just call it four agencies in a Northeastern state. Two of these agencies were in rural areas, and two of the agencies were in the city. They reached out to them by sending them an email with them to participate and along with the SurveyMonkey link. There was also one of those agencies that received hard copy instead of the SurveyMonkey link. They did it in hard copy. And again, all the participants, they were voluntary and anonymous. When they had these interviews with these people, they were open-ended questions that they used, that they focused mainly on the legally binding documents of non-hospital DNR and medical orders for life-sustaining treatment, and how pre-hospital providers responded when there was a conflict between written orders or the absence of those orders and the family's wishes about resuscitation. These interviews were done in the early 2017.
And Kathy, what were the analysis of the data?
So the article, basically, it presents the analysis of questions surrounding conflict, their confidence, and their comfort level in making complex decisions, and the ways that DNR and medical orders for life-sustaining treatment informed their end-of-life decisions. Basically, the survey data and interview data were collected separately, and they were not linked together to maintain anonymity of participants' responses. The analysis of the data was conducted sequentially. The survey data was analyzed first, and then the interview data was analyzed second. They used open coding along with axial coding to come up with, get a deeper meaning of the dynamics that occurred before and after death. That's pretty much how they collected and analyzed their data and came up with four themes that illuminated pre-hospital providers manage death in the field.
Can you explain for us what non-hospital DNR and medical or physician orders for life-sustaining treatment stands for, and give a brief description?
So I should have probably discussed this before we got into more of the body of this article. Basically, this is an American article. Non-hospital DNR is equivalent to the DNR confirmation form that we have here in Ontario that would be in a patient's home. It basically tells them that all of the same things that we state, no CPR, there will be no intubation, there will be no patients on the chest, there will be no pacing or defibrillation. Basically, it's equivalent to our DNR CF form. The medical orders for life-sustaining treatment, and they also interchange it in this article with physician orders for life-sustaining treatment. All of those orders are specifically a legal document that exists between the patient and their medical doctor. And it basically discusses their goals of care and their advanced care directives. So it explains everything. There are standing orders on that document that EMS can follow in the US. If they arrive and the patient, they have these orders standing, they can follow those orders. If the patient doesn't want to be resuscitated, it is documented there. But my understanding is that they still need to have a non-hospital DNR in place for them not to initiate CPR. So they would have to get in touch with a higher authority to follow through on those standing orders or consult with that physician. But that's basic. They're different than us. It basically is just like our advanced care planning that we have here, that patients have documents telling us what their wishes are at end of life.
Right. So in their homes, they would have these advanced care planning documents plus the DNRC that we have,
yes,
say here in Ontario.
Right.
And when the results were obtained, there were four themes that emerged. Can you discuss each of these four themes and what EMS personnel feel regarding these four areas?
So the four themes that emerged was, first, there was changing standards of care. The second one was eliminating false hope. The third one was transitioning care from patient to the family and transferring care after death. Each theme is described and illustrated with representative quotes. In this article, they have put some of the quotes in from the EMS people, that what their feelings are. But changing standards of care, basic of these pre-hospital care workers felt quite confident working through family disagreement when CPR was requested, but there was a DNR in place. Some of them did have conflict about what to do when there was a DNR and the family called 911. Often people were calling 911 because they wanted confirmation that the person was dying or had died, or they felt that it was their legal responsibility to call to come when somebody had died or were dying. And also some of their other feelings were that people are just emotional and they panic. And even though these documents are there in the home, they've called EMS, even though they know that EMS is not probably going to follow through on resuscitating them. So they did have some of them felt quite conflicted, but there are many of them that felt that they could very easily talk to families about the dying process and work through that. So many, for the most part, many of them agreed that they didn't feel conflicted when the person was dying and there is a DNR. And the family called 911. They felt very comfortable talking to the families. One of the other survey questions was, I feel conflicted about what to do if there is no DNR and the family asks us not to resuscitate. So most of them also felt quite good about working through these conversations with patients. I will say though, here in Ontario, if there is a DNR, which is focused on basically for first responders and for fire department can follow those orders also. But if the substitute decision maker here in Ontario chooses, they can override that DNR and say that they want the patient to be resuscitated. They can, but it sounds like in this article, I mean, nobody has said anything different in this article, but it appears that even if the DNR is there and the family wants them to resuscitate, they have conversations with the family. So
just a question, Kathy, so in your experience, the opposite way, if say you were a community nurse and you went into the home and you've mentioned if there was a DNR, the substitute decision maker could override that. Can it yes. also go the other way where if the substitute decision maker can say, do not resuscitate?
I think that here in Ontario, it is a conflict that would be difficult, but I think that here in Ontario, unless there is that document is in the home, our pre-hospital care workers need to initiate CPR and they will continue CPR for at least 20 minutes and until someone else tells them to stop or they've transported them onto hospital, dependent upon what state they're in. Like if they've already died, they're going to probably call a higher up from the home. But they do have to initiate, they are legally bound to initiate CPR, even though family doesn't want it.
Can you discuss termination of resuscitation and family witness resuscitation?
Oh, well, I haven't really finished up here on my themes here. That's okay.
I asked that extra question and then I got you off topic.
That's okay.
Okay, let's go
no
back.
Problem. That's okay. A lot of the participants, they explained that the change of pre-hospital orders historically was to initiate care and transport all the patients to the hospital. But now, you know, pre-hospital care has evolved to basically encompass both life-sustaining treatment and withholding of termination of it in the field. Most participants articulated how advances have informed changes in procedure and field resuscitation. So some of them, these are just some quotes from some of them. They stated that back in the day, you would work them and transport them. There was no question. I absolutely agree with that fact that we should be able to terminate resuscitation. It is our job to take the emergency room and extend it into the community and get the care to the patient quicker. There was some other participants who felt that they felt that it's long overdue. For the longest time, we were transporting everyone, even when we knew that it wasn't, the outcome was going to be futile. We've gotten better at handling it and it has proven itself. They really feel that the changing standards of care in the field resuscitation have necessitated a shift in best practice and it has increased the number of attempts that are stopped before transport. So some pre-hospital providers really felt conflicted about withholding resuscitation and lacked confidence in that decision-making about the termination of resuscitation and family witnessed resuscitation. There's some that feel quite strongly that once they don't like it when people just stop resuscitating the resuscitative efforts, they feel that they should continue with CPR until someone with a higher authority or training has taken over to make that decision. The next theme that came up in their study was eliminating false hope. For they feel that many pre-hospital care workers felt that resuscitation followed by transport to an emergency department, it increased family members' beliefs that the person was going to survive. This participant described families' experiences as most families are appreciative, and I do not think anybody likes false hope and certainly would not want them to die in the ambulance. So often many of the deaths in the community are often a natural death. They're not always, or there is sudden cardiac death, and often they cannot be resuscitated. And it's even if they are on that verge, like they are working them and they are getting some kind of a rhythm back and they're breathing for them, that can be done within the home or without moving them to the hospital. It would be preferable that they did die at home with family members nearby and people who knew them instead of with strangers in the back of an ambulance. So other participants explained that the importance of clear communication about death. They said, we try to use words like they're dead. We don't use words like they've passed on. They need to understand that they're dead. I don't like giving people false hope. I will often pull family members aside and explain to them that we're doing everything possible, but just their heart is not beating. They're not breathing on their own. We're doing everything in the hospital that we can do. And we're doing everything that the hospital could do right here. And at this point, they are dead. And he said that sometimes they do understand and accept this, but often people are just too emotional and blown away by the whole situation. So many of them felt that they were quite confident in explaining the dying process. And when they see that death is imminent, and most of them, another survey question was, I feel comfortable telling family that a patient is dying. And the majority of these people, all pre-hospital care people, were able to feel that they were good at doing this, that they had a good comfort level with explaining the dying process and supporting the family. They also feel that they create this false hope by taking them off to the hospital. Meanwhile, they have died already, and they know that they're not going to be able to resuscitate them. And then they get to the hospital and find out that they haven't survived, and that often this can be really traumatic for families, and they feel that it also interferes with the bereavement process. Transitioning care from the patient to the family. Basically, what happens is, and I used to find this as a community nurse myself, I'd be looking after people who had a terminal illness. And when they were getting close to end of life, your focus became more for the family. And this is what happens with pre-hospital care workers, that participants explain that they shifted their focus from the patient to the family when the death was imminent. Participants described the emotional intensity of leaving a body at the scene and how they helped families through the experience of terminating resuscitation. Simply stated, this participant reflected the changing emphasis. And he claimed we changed from actually treating who we were called for to see and being there for the family. And others have discussed that there's been a big push, even when I started, that the family was moved out of the room during a code and not allowed to watch. And studies were done and found that it was closure for the family to watch a resuscitation. And because they don't understand really what they're seeing and what's happening, and it gives them more closure. And a lot of times we get there and the person is not able to be saved. And you explain to the family how sorry you are and there is nothing that you can do. And many times they feel that patients are quite comfortable with that. The other situation that paramedics have out there in the community is they arrive on the scene and emotions are high. People are upset, especially if it's something that's happened. It could be something traumatic that's happened or a sudden cardiac death. And they have much to deal with. They have to really read the people in the room. They have to look at their environment that they're walking into. And they're trying to look after a patient and family, deal with family at the same time. Often they will take the patient and go to the emergency room just because of safety measures for themselves. It's not a safe scene sometimes. There is a lot on their plate. They have to be thinking about so much when they walk into these environments.
Right. Plus, they have to deal with all the ethical and plus the legal situations that might arise with proper or improper paperwork.
That's right. That's a real difficult situation for them. The next thing was transferring care after death. After termination of a resuscitation, the responsibility was transferred to law enforcement. Then a medical examiner may arrive, and then funeral directors. Participants explained how they prepared family members for this transition. And basically, they explained to the family that basically families just need a shoulder to cry on most of the time. And sometimes they want you to be that person that gives them the hug or be a strong, solid person for what's happening. The police, you have to explain to them that what's going to happen next, all the steps that will happen, that the police are going to come, the fire department is going to leave, the county medical examiner may or may not come. And some people need to have all those facts laid out to them. You have to be really factual with them. And this is a process. We're going to walk you through it. They also identified systemic outcomes of termination of resuscitation, including differential utilizations of the emergency department. They feel that it keeps the system down and that this is why the emergency rooms are not full. The only part that's difficult is waiting for the police to show up and then doing the paperwork with the family there. Sometimes it takes the police an hour or two. Participants basically articulated an intense emotional to the termination of termination of resuscitation in the field. When we arrived on one scene, a person was dead and the son came in and he wasn't understanding why his mother was still where she was on the floor. I had to explain to him it's because she's not alive and we have to leave her because it's considered a crime scene according to the New York State. And until the police get here, I can't touch her. We ruled out that she's not living anymore. We can't do anything for her. She's gone. After a bit, he calmed down and he started to realize and that he apologized. But those are kind of highly charged situations that these guys have to deal with before law enforcement shows up. Like even myself, I worked in an emergency room and I saw people put their fists through walls or bang their heads into walls. And it's pretty, at least we had security around and other people to help, like a chaplain who could go and sit with them and talk to them. Whereas these guys, they're sort of everything in the moment until law enforcement can arrive and others. Those were pretty much the four themes that emerged from their study.
Okay, and we'll go back to the other question that I did ask. Can you discuss termination of resuscitation and family witness resuscitation?
Okay, termination of resuscitation, family witness resuscitation, they are new important developments in providing pre-hospital end-of-life care in the field. The American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Care Medicine statements, they have statements on withholding and withdrawing non-beneficial medical interventions, and they have support it with withdrawing and withholding ventilatory support, hemodialysis, implanted cardiac defibrillation, CPR, basal pressors, artificial nutrition, hydration, and antibiotics, and when the burden exceeds the benefits. So previous research in out-of-hospital end-of-life decision-making and different types of medical orders, such as non-hospital DNR or the physician orders for life-sustaining treatment or medical orders for life-sustaining treatments, there's been some they've sort of identified that there's been significant confusion and concern about these documents, and it can negatively influence a patient's safety. Pre-hospital providers have operationalized good end-of-life care when they have upheld patient wishes. They have provided support in the dying process and have helped families with the end-of-life transition. There's research that shows that pre-hospital care, they've demonstrated a benefit in delaying transport to initiate critical medical interventions that became ineffective and potentially harmful while moving a patient. And as a result, pre-hospital providers have had prolonged family contact and decided when to switch from aggressive resuscitation measures to withdrawal of CPR, and that CPR was not in line with the patient's wishes and unlikely to be successful, and they were able to focus more on the family. study also explored the perspective of pre-hospital providers on managing death in the field using a converged survey and interview data. Those results sort of illustrated how legally binding documents have become central when CPR became futile. Participants described a trip to the hospital may have created false hope and it will prevent or undo a dying process. When CPR was not reestablished or returned to spontaneous circulation, participants described the importance of focusing their care on the family members who were trying to make sense of the dying or the death transition. Finally, participants articulated the importance of helping families understand that after death at home, the next steps occur differently than after death in a hospital. After death in a hospital, they are pronounced and basically we find out about organ donation or if they, who the funeral home is that they would want. You do talk to families about those things, but in the community, when people die outside of hospital and possibly do not have all the right documents in place, law enforcement is called. It sounds like even when the documents are in place, that law enforcement is called outside of hospital here in the US. And then it's discussed after that whether the coroner comes and then on to the funeral home. There are different steps between community and in the hospital. Basically, this, I was sort of shocked when I read this because I've been nursing since 1981. And in this article, it basically states the American Heart Association had recommended that family members should be offered the option of being present during cardiac arrest and termination of resuscitation, and that this has been in place and something that was put forward by them in 1987. And I know for a fact that there have never been in any of my hospital situations, and I've seen a lot of cardiac arrests and been involved with them, where family were never allowed to be involved or witness this. It's been recommended that family members should be offered the option to be present. They feel that it's good for them to see these things, that it helps them with the grieving process, and that it hits them that the reality that everything is being done for this patient and that it is futile and that they have died. There is that side of it. But on the other side of things, for people who are doing the code, for those pre-hospital care workers who are in the hospital and or not in the hospital, but in the patient's home, and they are doing CPR, and attempting to save this person's life, it can be a distraction for them. It can also be anxiety riding for them. And it can also sort of develop some medical legal issues for them if people feel something wasn't done right for them to be witnessing it. But essentially, in the community, when EMS arrives in someone's home and they do initiate CPR, they are witnessing the whole situation.
They have similar backgrounds, Kathy, with the ICU and the emergency department. And I've never actually sort of reflected on that piece of what happens when a person actually has resuscitation in the home and the EMS actually has to go in and it's all witnessed by the family.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's very different. I haven't even seen CPR in the community, and I worked out there for 12 years. But when I was in other areas, yeah, they were never allowed to come in. We usually put them somewhere like a quiet room and the chaplain was usually present, would be the go-between, the liaison between what might be happening in the room and what to the family. But that's sort of where it was. We never allowed them to witness it. I was really shocked when I saw that this was in this article, that this was something that was the American Heart Association had recommended this in 1987. They feel that they just feel that family witnessing a resuscitation helps them focus on the reality that death is imminent or that they have died and that everyone has done everything they possibly can to save that life. So.
And can you discuss with us what the limitations of the study were?
Yeah, so there were only this, so the limitations to consider, the sample was drawn from only one region. It was a very small region. It's not really reflective of everything going on in the US. There may have been differences in practices and perspectives and the barriers that were not captured. Some of the data was collected in 2017. And the continued evolution of the practice may not be reflected. It is likely that pre-hospital providers who have participated in this study in managing death in the field were more likely to support termination of resuscitation, therefore limiting a different viewpoint from others. So pre-hospital providers who participated in this study and interview were self-selecting, likely because they had an interest in or a particular perspective on the field of termination of resuscitation, and therefore they feel that there has been some bias introduced into this study.
Can you explain what might be the clinical implications for EMS personnel?
Well, for EMS personnel, they're pretty familiar with their guidelines and about withholding resuscitation, and the impact of that process on caregivers actually has not been studied well. Bereavement-related depression and post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms have been commonly seen in family members of cardiac arrest victims. However, the magnitude of that effect was not impacted by whether they witnessed the CPR in the emergency department. Sudden death can be devastating for the bereaved, who struggle to grasp the reality of potentially the resulting in a complicated grief. The issue of an unwanted resuscitation has sometimes been addressed by educating families not to call 911. This approach may be unrealistic. Families who are overwhelmed by an imminent death may call 911 regardless of the instructions that they are given. And telling families not to call 911 may also deprive them of the compassionate support that pre-hospital care providers can provide. I'm really not sure, like, they don't really talk too much about what it looks like in the community for end of life for people in the US in this particular article. I'm not sure if they have community nurses visiting in the home and if these DNR and medical orders for life-sustaining treatment do exist in their homes, then if they're being told not to call 911, what is happening? Do they just allow them to have a natural death? But because funeral homes are not about to remove a body from a home unless law enforcement is somehow involved. I'm not really sure. I mean, here in Ontario, we have a whole process where there is the DNR in the home, and we also have Edith, which is expected death in the home. And essentially, those documents give direction to our paramedics and to firefighters who may arrive on the scene that it doesn't need to be done, that this person is terminal and that they are end of life. But the problem arises when those documents have not been filled out or have not been completed, and therefore they end up with kind of situations out there in the community right now. But for the most part, everyone, usually if they know that they are end of life, we do have a DNR in place and an Edith in place.
What you're saying is the study basically discussed what happens with the EMS personnel but didn't mention what happens if there's nursing.
Yeah, I'm not really sure if there is nursing. I'm kind of want to be hopeful that maybe there is nursing coming into the home there, but it's hard to know because they have such a different healthcare system than we do here in Ontario or in Canada. Everywhere is different, but at least in Ontario, it's very different than what goes on in the US. So,
and what were the conclusions of the study?
So essentially, the conclusion of this study was that pre-hospital providers did provide good end-of-life care when they uphold the patient's wishes and notify families of imminent death. They're good at providing emotional support in the dying process and helping families with near-death transitions. So they've become present for and with families as they began to grasp the devastating loss and provide instrumental support to the next steps after death. Essentially, it was felt that, in conclusion, that pre-hospital providers were able to provide support and care when they told families that someone had died. Being able to comfort and be present with acute grief on scene is an important and evolving role for pre-hospital providers who manage deaths in the field.
I know, Kathy, you did discuss quite a bit about the DNRC process and the pre-hospital process here in Ontario. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Yeah, this DNRCF, which is Do Not Resuscitate Confirmation Form, I had kind of looked to see if there was an article that I could sort of mirror with this article, if there had been any studies done in Canada, but there were not. But I just sort of wanted to bring forward that this Do Not Resuscitate Confirmation Form is specifically only for EMS people and for the fire department if they show up on the scene. And basically, there should be an order sitting somewhere, either in an electronic file, in the nursing agency. If they're involved, they should be involved. If someone is terminally ill and has a DNR in the home, they need to have that order in place, because this Do Not Resuscitate Confirmation Form is not specific to nursing. They need to have a DNR, a legal DNR form order from the physician. This DNR form is specific only to EMS providers and like first responders. I think that's something that's really important. This was brought up a while ago at an in-service that I attended, and it was a long while ago, and I thought I was going to throw up, because we had always sort of, the DNR is in place, and the DNR wouldn't be in place if physician didn't think it was so. But often the physician doesn't sign these DNRs. Nursing is doing this out in the field. And because this was in place and it was the patient's wish, but really nursing should be sending their POS across, at least here in our communities. They should be sending a POS to that doctor and requesting a DNR order. They should be requesting orders to pronounce that patient, and also getting all that information from them if they're available, and how to reach them for a medical certificate of death, and someone as backup if they're not available, and their phone numbers. So that's basically the process here in Ontario. If EMS shows up and this form is not available, and families say that they have the form but they can't find it, they're still going to proceed with CPR.
Right. They're obligated.
They are totally obligated. Yeah, legally.
And can you just comment how that process is combined with the EDITH form, the expected death in the home form?
So it is a folder. It's called expected death in the home. There is a medical certificate of death in that folder. There is the DNR is in that folder. And there is another form that is filled out that has all of the information on it that you're requesting. DNR is, there's an area to fill in for the do not resuscitate order. There is also an area to fill in for the physicians, who is the person that we call, because it may not be the nurse who looks after them going out to see that patient when they die. The doctor's phone number, his name, and his alternate phone number. And if he is unavailable, there's always another alternate physician should be documented there to be available to cover for him. And then down below, there is another part to that form, is the who is to pronounce this patient. It's usually the nurse to pronounce, which is checked off. And then there's a whole other area after the patient dies that you fill in, giving time of death, the date of the death, and, you know, just documenting that there were no vitals. Patient.
Right. And basically the EDITH form cuts out the process of having to inform police or have a coroner involved in the case, correct?
Definitely. That's the whole thing. That's the whole great idea of having this expected death in the home. It's traumatic enough for people, even though it is an expected death. People are upset and emotional. They do not need the added trauma of having to have us show up and police show up in the coroner if he does come. Usually they don't in these cases. It's a really traumatic and long process. Like, there's a lot of waiting around. Some of this takes hours. The police can be sitting there with a body for like maybe 6 or 7 hours. This could be someone who has died and family isn't around. We hope that those things don't happen, but it can be a very traumatic process for families. It's best to really be having those discussions, even though they are difficult sometimes, and trying to get this information and all of these documents in place and in order.
Well, that was a great study. I know it was from the US, Kathy, but you did a fantastic job on informing our audience on what happens in Ontario. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
No, except that I had to do a lot of research with all of this. You don't have to add this into this recording, but there was a lot of stuff in here, a lot of things like physician orders for life-sustaining treatment and medical orders for life-sustaining treatment. And when you went to look all of that up, you found out that this was really just their advanced care planning, and it was a legal document between physician and patient, which is very similar to what we do here with advanced care planning, although the physician is very much aware of what patients want, their patient wants at end of life, but it's not really, there's no legal document. And that's another thing. MS here, our pre-hospital, like our first responders, they cannot respond to a legal document like that. They have to have a DNR in place. In the summertime around here, our communities do have a lot of Americans travel up here. I know when I worked in our hospital, we would have people end up in the ICU from cardiac arrest, and they often had documents like a living will, but you know, we couldn't follow those things. They're not legal in our country. And it's best if you would have had to look after that person, they would have to resuscitate them. They would have no choice. Even once they maybe ended up in the hospital, that would be up to physician talking on the phone to decide whether to remove them from life support with the family's consent. So,
well, thank you so much, Kathy. I thoroughly enjoyed our discussion today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.